Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome back to Social Psychology. Today we will be talking about social influence and social change. Last week we talked about attitude change and persuasion. So these three sessions of attitudes and how to define and measure them and to see when attitudes predict our behavior. Then the last session of attitude change and persuasion, and today's session on social influence belong together and form a group of lectures on similar topics. The two multiple choice questions from last week. When Karen hears graphic news about disasters, she becomes somewhat distressed, focused and attentive. However, when she gets extremely stressed, she's so uptight that she becomes distracted from the details of the story. This sequence characterizes the J curve, boomerang effect, reactance response, or the inverted U curve. Thank you. It's the inverted U curve. Remember, we had that slide showing that a little bit of fear aroused by the message increases the likelihood for successful attitude change and persuasion, but when it exceeds a medium level and is too strong, then people don't pay attention. We've discussed this with the example of cigarette packages, and when the pictures on it are too fear-arousing, then people do not buy the packages anymore but switch to other modes, or they put the package in another package to not being able to see the picture, etc. In Petty and Cacioppo's elaboration likelihood model, people are never assumed to take mental shortcuts, or a central route is used when the message is delivered in visual form, or a peripheral route is used when attention to the argument of a message is low, or persuasion occurs only when the source is likable.
C.
A peripheral route is used when attention to the argument of a message is low. That's what we discussed. So when people either lack the motivation or the ability or don't have the ability to pay attention to strong arguments, then there may still be persuasion, but via the peripheral route. And on the peripheral route, we may have source likability, for example, that influences whether people change their attitude or not, but not necessarily the arguments of the message. Someone last week asked me whether in the experiment of Zimbardo and colleagues that I showed you about the grasshoppers, whether there were differences in the two conditions between the positive and the negative officer in how many people actually ate them or did not eat them. And I downloaded the old paper from 1965 and found that very interesting, because actually it's much more complex than what's in the textbook. Apparently there was a study before by Smith and colleagues, I think in 1961, who did a similar thing and found similar results, but they did this in groups of people, and Zimbardo and colleagues speculated that probably the groups had influenced each other, and therefore they ran the experiment three times more. In one condition with college students, and in two other conditions with soldiers. And in the two soldier experiments, there was one condition in which all the soldiers sat around the table, and here indeed there was some influence, both positively and negatively, by some soldiers making comments about the grasshoppers. And in the other condition, they just gave instructions, but the people received these instructions separately in like little individual cubicles. And in this condition, there was a further manipulation. That is, they were paid, I think, 50 cents, which may equal like 5 euros today, for eating for each grasshopper they ate. And I'm roughly... So what could the money have been led to? What do you think? what might the additional reward of getting 50 cents per grasshopper's head effect be? Yes, please. Okay, it could have led some people not to do it because they were feeling reactance, or but afterwards, on the whether they before and after were asked whether they like grasshoppers, what effect would that have on the change in attitude? Justify?
Mm-hmm. Justify that they did eat them.
But?
Well, probably they would just justify it by, I don't know, saying that they got 50 cents.
Exactly.
They justified the money instead of the money.
Exactly. That's why Zimbardo et al. Introduced this further manipulation in addition to the negative and the positive officer, and it did have a slight effect in this direction. So those who received the orders from a negative communicator and were not rewarded for it changed their attitudes the most, although this effect was only marginally significant. Anyway, what I came across was the experiment itself was much more complicated than the textbook says. The officers, or in the condition with college students, the communicators, were not friendly or unfriendly to the participants. To the participants who were asked to aid or not, to eat the grasshoppers and then either ate them or not ate them, the officer communicated in a very neutral, standardized way. But in both conditions, there was a confederate or assistant of the experimenter who made a mistake. And this was observed, the reaction of the officer or communicator in dealing with his assistant making a mistake was observed by the real participants before they were asked to eat grasshoppers. And in one condition, the officer was very friendly to this assistant, called him by his first name, and was not making a critical comment on the mistake. Whereas in the other condition, he was very unfriendly, called him by his last name, shouted at him that he did make this mistake, and sent him away in a very unfriendly way. So the officer was seen by the participants before they were actually interacting with this person as either friendly or less friendly to a third person. This is probably important to know. As of the eating or not eating ratio, it was roughly the same. So in one part of the text, Zimbardo and colleagues simply say it was 50% in both conditions. And in the only table in which they gave exact numbers, it was 50% in the positive communicator conditions overall and 45% in the negative condition overall. But it apparently isn't such a big difference. Okay, but I found this interesting, and maybe we should do that more often and go into the original studies and see what the researchers actually have done, but apparently the task of a textbook author summarizing many experiments in chapters on each topic is not to go into each and every detail. You would find that boring and would not be able to remember anything. But from time to time, I think it's interesting to see what is actually going on. Okay, then let's talk about social influence and social change today. So we will discuss forms of social influence such as obedience to authority, power, compliance with requests, and internalized conformity to group norms. And then we also talk about minority group influence. Social influence can produce compliance, which may be on the surface, it's not true attitude change, but social influence can also produce conformity to group norms that is internalized by people. So when we internalize the group norms communicated to us, either by the group itself because we identify with it, or by a convincing communicator who we obey to and show obedience to, we can either show public surface compliance or internalized private conformity. And people tend to be more readily influenced by reference groups, those they like, admire, identify with, than by the groups that they are simply members of. And we can distinguish between informational and normative conformity. Informational conformity is any change in our opinions that occurs as a result of our desire for having accurate knowledge. And the result of informational influence typically is private acceptance or real change in opinions of us or any other individual. Normative conformity, on the other hand, occurs when we express opinions or behave in ways that help us to be accepted by the group or the person who tries to influence us, or that keep us from being isolated or rejected by the group. And public compliance involves a change in behavior that is not normally accompanied by an actual change in one's private opinion. Okay? So sometimes we show publicly compliance with what the group or the communicator wants us to do because we want to avoid being rejected, isolated, etc. But that does not lead to private acceptance and real change of opinion. When we, however, change our opinion due to our desire for accurate knowledge and we study the information, then we show private conformity or informational conformity. You can compare this a little bit with the central and the peripheral route of the elaboration likelihood model. And the same is true throughout this session. When we later on talk about majority influence, we can compare it with the peripheral route of the elaboration likelihood model, whereas minority influence may have influences via the central route, because minorities influence people in a way that they look for accurate knowledge, and if they are convinced, if the minority has strong arguments, then they are convinced also in private and show informational conformity and not only public compliance that we would expect when we simply do what a majority tells us, because the majority has the advantage of a large number, and typically we also don't want to be rejected or isolated when we are members of a certain majority of people. Now, to obedience to authority, and authority and power is one way of an individual person influences what we do or think. Given the right circumstances, we all have the potential to obey commands blindly, even if the consequences of such obedience include harm to others. That's a very bold statement. Given the right circumstances, whatever they may be, we all, me, you, everyone, has the potential to blindly obey commands, even if we do harm to others. And I will show you the study by Stanley Milgram in a moment that you probably all have heard about before, in which Milgram wanted to test this assumption. And his background was that he wanted to understand the Holocaust. You may also have heard about Eichmann in Jerusalem from Hannah Arendt, who also studied how came that people in Germany during the Holocaust apparently blindly followed orders and obeyed commands of those higher up in the organizational, political, army, whatever group they were working in, higher up in these organizations or groups, hierarchy. They blindly followed commands, even if it clearly involved harm to other people. And he devised this experiment, and I will tell you more about this in a moment. And he also devised several variations of this experiment so that we now know we not the right circumstances may, for example, involve proximity to the victim or the person in authority, the legitimacy of the authority, or social support for obedience or disobedience signaled by other conditions in the experimental setup. So the right circumstances need to be right, but given that there are the right circumstances, the experiment has shown that we can indeed sometimes blindly follow commands by others, even if we do harm to others. So Milgram did this study in the 1950s and wrote a book about them called Obedience to Authority. Participants were assigned to the role of teacher and a confederate to the role of a learner. So two people came into the laboratory, then there was a lottery, and one person, the real participant, was always made the teacher, and the other person, the researcher's confederate, was always made the learner. Then the participant, who was a teacher, believed that the learner was another participant and that this assignment was random. Okay? The teacher was then told that the research was looking at the effect of punishment on learning, and he was encouraged to give increasingly severe electric shocks to the learner when the learner made mistakes on a task. In the setup of the experiment that became the classic experiment, the learner was in another room of the teacher. So the teacher sat in one room, had a microphone, gave instructions to the learner who was sitting in another room. The teacher had a shock generator in front of him with voltages from 0 to 400 and some written comments like severe shock, serious shock, danger, and then just XXX. Before the teacher was set in front of the shock generator, they all together, experimenter, teacher, and learner, went into the other room where the teacher saw that the learner was put on a chair and was fixed to the chair with his arms and legs, where this learner would receive the electric shocks. Then the teacher with the experimenter withdrew into the other room and was given instructions. So typically he had to read four words, the learner had to memorize one of the key words, and in the next trial the four words were read again, and when the learner did not select the correct word, the teacher gave an electric shock. And first it started with 10 volts and then it continuously grow stronger and stronger. And of course the learner was not a relearner, it was a confederate, so he stripped himself off and then just pressed a button on a tape recorder so that standardized feedback was given. So in every condition there was the same number of false responses, and after a certain number of shocks the learner began to shout, began to cry, or said things like, oh, I have a heart condition and let me out of here, or I don't want to continue. And in these conditions, the teachers often said, or in these trials, the teachers often said, I don't want to continue. And the experimenter always said, the experimenter requires you to continue, please go on. So the teachers were not forced. Sometimes the teacher said things like, you can keep your $5 that I came here and that I assigned, that's why I signed up for the experiment. And then the experimenter said, no, it's not about the $5, you will receive your $5 anyway, but the experiment requires you to continue. Okay? And when pushed by the experimenter to continue with the shocks, 65% of participants gave shocks up to 550 volts that were labeled as danger, severe shock, despite they were not getting any response anymore from the learner in the last two or three trials. So the experiment, the teacher read the four words, there was no response. The experimenter said, please press the shock button. When there's no response, it counts as a wrong response. So at that stage, the teacher must have thought that the person in the other room was fainted or maybe even dead, who knows. And 65% of participants went all the way and pressed the final button on the shock generator. And this is a statement what led Milgram to formulate this. Given the right circumstances, we all follow commands blindly. We obey authority blindly, even if we clearly know that another person is suffering. Now, Milgram did not believe that the teachers were evil people. He believed it was a social situation and not the people themselves that was most important. And therefore, he also conducted a number of variations of experiments. And this is what you normally see in textbooks. So he conducted 15 variations on his original procedure, and each of which demonstrated changes in the situation could influence the outcome. There's a book written in Australia 4 or 5 years ago by Gina Perry. The book is entitled Behind the Shock Machine. And she actually went into the archives of Princeton University where Milgram was working. And she found that Milgram had conducted even more experiments, some experiments of which he might have been so embarrassed in hindsight that he didn't even put them in his book. In one variation of the experiment, he asked fathers and sons or neighbors to come to the laboratory together, then did the lottery, and then apparently fathers believed that they were punishing their sons or vice versa, or neighbors believed that they were shocking the respective other neighbors. And the worst thing was that Milgram did not fully debrief them afterwards. So he did not directly after the experiment tell them about the whole setup, etc., because he was afraid that they were talking to the general public and that he therefore could not continue with his experiments. He also did some other unethical things, as we would call them today. So I think today it would be extremely difficult to conduct a similar experiment, and for good reasons. When we do experiments that can potentially do harm to other people, and I'm not talking about the learner, I'm talking about the teacher, the real participants, who you can see in some video documents that you find on YouTube, are under real stress. So when you put people under real stress, you always need approval by an ethics committee or institutional review board, and for good reasons. And this is very good to do so. However, there have been replications of Milgram's experiments. I don't know. I first show you the results. This is what Milgram himself had expected. So Milgram had expected that no one would go all the way through and apply shocks that were labeled extreme intensity, danger, or XXX. And he also predicted that only very few, so 10% maybe, would give shocks that were between 135 and 180 volts. This is the actual curve of this one classic experiment, the one variation that I have just described to you. And because the curve looks the way it does look, if you analyze the data, you will find that those people who pass this threshold are most likely to go all the way through. So either people stop here, or there's a good likelihood that most of them will also continue to 450 volts. And because of that, there are there's at least one replication that also has been published a few years ago with ethical approval, with full debriefing the participants, of course, with consent and making clear everything was voluntary, etc. So it met the ethical expectations that we now have to an experiment. But the shock generator just stopped somewhere here at 200 volts. And what had been found in this replication, that again, about 60% continued until the end. And you could expect that those people who were tested, say, in 2005, would have gone all the way through if the experiment would have set up the same way as Milgram had set it up. Now, in the initial study that I just showed you, the authority status and power was maximized. So people were signing up to an experiment, I think at Princeton or Yale University. Yale University. He wore a white lab coat. The participants were not only asked to come to the experiment, but the experiment itself happened in Yale University. Whereas in other conditions, for example, the experimenter did not wear a lab coat and the experiment happened in a rundown industrial park somewhere in Connecticut. But in this study, and the problem is it was not the initial study. It was one of the studies that Milgram had conducted, and then he selected this study to create the obedience to authority story around it, if you wish. But in this study, the authority status and power was maximized. And in replications, the experimenter's authority decreased, and so also the level of obedience was reduced. Obedience was reduced to 20% when the experimenter's ability to express his authority was limited by making him more distant to the teacher. So when he sat in another room and was only connected to the teacher by telephone. When the teacher gave the shock in the same room that the learner was sitting in, and the teacher could see this person's distress, obedience was also reduced from 65 to 40%. Milgram studies also confirmed the role, the importance of unanimity, because when there were two research participants as a teacher and one of the teachers, which was also a confederate of the experimenter, of course, first started giving some shocks, but then later refused to continue. And then the participant was asked to take over, then only 10% were obedient to the very end. And if two experimenters were present in the room and only one proposed to continue shocking while the other argued for stopping the shocks, no research participants continued to shock anymore. So this is some of the experiments that we find in Milgram's original material and in the obedience to authority. This was the study that I described, and percent obedience means how many people or what percentage of people go all the way and shock to 450 volts. And you see that there are conditions that reduce it a little bit. So when it was not at Yale University, but at Bridgeport, when the experimenter was in another room, when not an experimenter in a lab coat, but an ostensibly ordinary man and other research participants gave orders, you see that there was a decline in obedience. When the participant held the learner's hand on the shock pad, there was still 20% obedience. I can hardly imagine how that would work. So every time the learner makes a mistake, you put his hand on a shock pad, and then this confederate, the learner, obviously had to make some reaction, had to give some response to it, and probably also showed great distress. When there was other research participants who refused to give shock, it was sharply declined. When the teacher could choose his own preferred shock level, there were still 2% people who went to 450 volts. This is probably the person and not the situation's effect. So, of course, not all the people invited to the laboratory are evil people, but some people are abnormal, like in every population, and probably these 2% were reflecting this. And as I said, when there were two experimenters and they were not unanimous in their orders, and when one experimenter suggested not to shock, then indeed no one continued all the way through. If you look at this, these variations of experiments, as Alex Haslam and Stephen Riker and others have recently done and reanalyzed it, not in technical quantitative terms, but in qualitative terms, reanalyze it from a social identity perspective, we could also understand Milgram's result as the type and level of identification determining whether we follow or do not follow a norm. Whenever the setup was in a way that the participant, the teacher, could identify with the teacher, because there was only one teacher who was highly respected, who was in the same room and gave unanimous orders to continue shocking, then following this norm was strongest. When the experimenter was removed from direct experience, or when the experimenter was in another room or was not associated with research, then the teacher did not identify so strongly with research anymore and therefore did not follow the norm so strongly. And in the conditions in which the teacher was more associated with the learner, when they were in the same room or when the teacher had to hold the hand of the learner on the shock pad, then obedience was also sharply reduced or was even more reduced. So if you give it a social identity interpretation, then we can also understand the different variations, not only in terms of level of proximity and unanimity, but in terms of identification with one of the two possibilities that you have in these conditions, either the experimenter and science, or the learner and humanism or individuality. Any questions to this? Yes, please. Yes, there are a lot of these interviews, both Milgram in the exploration after the experiments in some variations asked the learner, asked the teachers why they did follow all the way through, and some of them said, yeah, because he told me or because you told me. Some of them said, yeah, because the experiment was requiring it. Gina Perry also visited some of the participants 30 years or 50 years after the original experiments and interviewed them. And some of them clearly were distressed by them, what they have done. Some of them reported having had nightmares after the experiment for several weeks or months after the experiment. Maybe not because they are genuinely meaning it and were sarcastic or sadistic people, but because they were so distressed themselves that they had to have some justification for what they just experienced to be doing. Okay. So what we see in this experiment is that group norms are enormously potent sources of conformity. And we all normally tend to yield to the majority. And when an experimenter tells us what we have to do, then this experimenter has power because we represent the majority of researchers, scientists, etc. Conformity can be reduced when the task is unambiguous, people are not under surveillance, but even under these circumstances, there's often residual conformity, as we have seen in some of the variations of Milgram's experiments. Lack of unanimity among the majority is particularly effective in reducing conformity. So the two experimenters disagreeing with each other is just an example for the general effect of finding that even if a majority of many people or a high power tries to convince us, we are not so easily convinced when there's disagreement, unanimity, or lack of unanimity among the majority. People may conform in order to feel sure about the objective validity of their perceptions and opinions. That would be informational conformity. To obtain social approval and avoid social disapproval, or to express or validate their social identity as members of a specific group. And now I show you a series of studies that have been conducted to test these effects of group norms, of potent sources of conformity, unanimity or lack of unanimity as one important factor of majority influence, and different ways of increasing or reducing conformity. So the first experiment or series of experiments was conducted by Muzaffer Sharif. Muzaffer Sharif is a Turkish social psychologist who worked in the United States, and we will come across him next week or week after that when we talk about group processes, because he conducted the famous summer camp studies with 11-year-old boys that shows hostility between groups and the reasons for it. But this was much earlier, and he wanted to study the influence of group norms on people's attitudes in situations with high ambiguity, when there's no objective standard. And he used the so-called autokinetic effect. When you are in a completely dark room, and a few meters apart of you there's a small spot of light, this spot of light seems to move because of the involuntary movements of your eyes. So there is no real movement, but we all would see this dot of light moving around or shifting around. But it's objectively not moving, and people, because the room is completely dark, there's no standard to orient, people don't know how much it is moving. And when they are asked individually, alone in a room, they vary greatly in what they say. So between, so this is inches, so just between 1 centimeter and maybe 20 centimeters or 15 centimeters. Next, the participants do the experiment in a group where 3 or 4 people sit together in a room, and then they each give an estimate in various sessions or trials. And you see that slowly but surely the group converges to some group standard, group norm. And at the end, after 4 trials, everyone estimates the same number of movement, the same distance. In another series of experiments, Sharif switched the order around and had people make their estimates in a group condition, so where 3 people were sitting in a room, and then first this person, and then that person were making a statement. And you see that there was some variation. Variation was already much smaller than in this condition, because probably the second and third person making his or her estimate is already affected by his preceding colleagues or participants. And when they continue to make this group decision, they converge around this norm. And interestingly, this condition, when afterwards people make then their decisions again alone and not in front of the other participants, they still tend to adhere to this group norm. So this means that in groups, norms are formed and created that influence individuals in the group situation. But we also see that when groups have established their norm, this norm can have an effect on the individual's perceptions or attitudes, even when the group is no longer present. Another experiment by Deutsch and Gerard. This is another experiment that I wanted to show you. The question sometimes arises when I show experiments like this or other experiments, and I think we briefly discussed it last week already. Who is more easily convinced or persuaded? Is it men or is it women? And the original experiments by Howland and colleagues in the 1940s and 50s showed that women tend to be influenced a little bit more easily than men. And then Sistrunk and McDavid tested an assumption by Alice Aglia and colleagues who said, yeah, maybe it is because all the experimenters are male and maybe they are also studying what is of interest to male people designing the experiments. So Sistrunk and colleagues tested this idea, and they used items that were masculine, so tools and wrenches, or more feminine. I mean, this was in the very early 1970s. Types of needlework that was apparently a feminine domain, and maybe still is, but I'm not sure whether today's experimenter would use items of needlework as particularly feminine item of expertise, or neutral things. And as you can see, when the items presented were masculine, then women were more conforming than men, but the opposite was true when there was something about items that women had more expertise of. Now men were showing more conformity in the experimental setup than women, and when the items were indeed neutral, then there was no difference in male and female conformity. Now we can differentiate between majority influence and minority influence. We start with majority influence when obviously a larger group of people tends to influence or change the opinions of a smaller group of people. And minority influence is the opposite, and we talk about this later. And Solomon Asch was inventing this line of research on the majority with his classic line perception studies. This is the real participant, and the other six were confederates of the experimenter. The real participant was always making his judgments second last. So there were five confederates who made their estimates, statements, whatever, before the real participant. And you could see that this guy is a bit worried. So he tries to really identify what is going on. And it was very simple. In control conditions, no one makes an error in this type of studies. So you see a standard line, and then you see three comparison lines, and you should identify which of these three lines matches the length of the standard line. So very simple. Apparently it's B in this situation. But what would you do if you see the comparison lines and in this setup, five people in front of you go and say A? And you are sitting there, you are the real participant, you don't know that the others are confederates, you don't know why they all respond wrongly. You may think, oh, it's probably because of my glasses. Maybe I'm sitting in a weird angle to the material. Maybe all the others are true. But maybe you also say, if they all say A, then I probably also say A, otherwise they criticize me, or whatever reasons they may have to say A, I better go with the majority. When tested alone, they did not make any mistakes, but in the experimental conditions when they had to make their statements aloud, and the others, the Confederates, gave the same wrong answer before it was the participant's turn, then at least sometimes the real participant also gave an incorrect answer. 76% of all the men tested in this original series gave at least one incorrect response, although the material was very simple and easy, as I showed you. Conformity, however, was not absolute. 24% of the men never conformed, and only 5% of the men conformed on all 12 of the critical trials. So obviously it was not only 12 trials, there was a number of trials, but in some trials the Confederates made the right statement in order for the real participant not to believe that the Confederates themselves were short-sighted or blind or whatever. Now, where does this influence come from? Why do 76% of the men gave at least once an incorrect answer, although they knew it was wrong? Generally, we feel pressure to conform to the group standards. Whenever we are in a group, we feel some pressure to do as the others do, whatever that may be. It's in terms of dress, it's in terms of language that we use, it's in terms of appropriate norms for talking to each other, and we feel some pressure. Even if the group does not have any power over us in the formal sense. And conformity is more likely, but conformity is more likely in some groups than in others, and some of the factors that produce more conformity are well known. And one factor, for example, is certainty of the stimulus. And Deutsch and Gerard repeated Ash's experiments, but they varied some conditions. In one thing that they varied was uncertainty. In the low uncertainty condition, they presented the standard line and the three reference lines. In the high uncertainty condition, they presented the standard lines, took the standard line away, and then presented the three reference lines and said, now you have to choose A, B, or C. Obviously, the second condition creates some uncertainty, and you may not be so sure anymore whether it was A, B, or C, because you cannot directly compare the four lines. And the other variable that he varied was the degree of group pressure. In this situation, the real participants sat around the table with the Confederates, and the experimenter said, it's important that you all give the correct answer. You will only be rewarded if the whole group give the right answer. So there was strong group pressure here, strong conformity was seen because of the group goal. When you know the others are around and we are dependent on giving all the right answer, and five people in front of you give the incorrect answer, then it's much more difficult for you apparently to provide the right answer. And you see that there was also an effect of certainty, uncertainty. In the low uncertainty condition, there was a little bit less than 50% induced errors by others giving the wrong response. When the material was absent, when there was more uncertainty, this raised to 55%. In the second condition, which was basically the original setup of Solomon Asch. We see that dependent on whether the stimulus was absent, high certainty, or whether the stimulus was present, conformity or induced errors were somewhere between 25 and 35%, which is a little bit similar to S responses. In the private and anonymous condition, it was again the same setup as in S paradigm, but this time the participant, the real participant, was asked to not make the statement aloud, but to make his statement privately and anonymously on a sheet of paper. So this, the other participants were still making their estimates aloud and public, but this participant, I guess the experimenters had selected him or her by another artificial procedure, and this participant was not asked to also give his statements aloud, but make them private and anonymous. And you see that socially induced errors are very low, and particularly in the situation in which the stimulus was still present and was a little bit higher, but much lower than in the typical setup of ASH with the other group members being around. Okay, so as it said on the other slide, that the social factors that produce more or less conformity are well known, and group pressure is one of these factors, but also the material and whether there's more or less certainty impacts on whether people conform or not. Variations of Ash studies have shown that when the number of people in the majority increased relative to the number of people in the minority, the pressure also increases, and therefore there's more conformity and more errors, for example, in this experiment. This is true whether the conformity is normative or informational. So sometimes we also see informational conformity in a majority. A majority does not only have normative influences, but can also sometimes change people's attitudes via the central route when they have strong arguments, when it's important for the participants. But again, we see more influence when the number in the majority is higher relative to the number of the minority. In variations of Ash studies, the number of incorrect responses by Confederates was increased from 1 to 16, so just one other participant and one real participant, up to 16 Confederates of the experimenter. And Ash found that the larger the majority, the more likely it was that the only participant also gave the incorrect answer. But this is normative conformity. Increasing the size of the majority only increases conformity up to a certain point. So yes, it's true, as the number of the majority increases, for example, from 1 to 16, one would not be really a majority. So only when there are two Confederates and one real participant, then we would have a small minority of 2 versus 1. But 16 clearly is a large majority. And in these experiments, what had been seen was the larger the number of majority relative to the only participant, the more influence there was. But this goes only up to a certain point, and this is also called social impact theory by Latané. It's the increase in the amount of conformity that is produced by each new member of the group. That's social impact. And it's greater for the initial majority members. So the first, second, and third do have more impact than the 12th, 13th, and 14th in Ash studies. And this was shown in an experiment by Milgram, Bickman, and Berkowitz, who studied the number of people gawking on a city street. We also tested this for television a few years ago, where we stood in the city of Mainz, and some of us were looking into the sky. And when you have just one or two people, then people stop and look into the sky. And when you have many people, then eventually the effect of additional people wanes off again. So this is the result. I don't know why people do that, or I have some ideas why people do that, but it's very interesting. You can repeat it right after the lecture. Go somewhere, start staring into the sky, and have someone observe what other people do. Or do it at the Body of Knowledge in the West End when you have lunch this afternoon in the Mensa. Just have someone standing there gawking, and then look what happens. So when no one gawks, no one else gawks, okay. When one person stands and is gawking into the sky, you see that 40% of the passers-by also look up, however briefly. When there's one more person, then of course there is more impact. You see that 2, 3, 4, 6 people have more impact. The number of people who gawk moves up from 0 to 40, then 60, 70, up to 80%. But the amount of influence that this one additional person has is smaller than the first person had. The amount that two more people then, or one more people has over the third one, is again smaller. So that would be 40%, that would be 20%, that would only be 10%, and then it needs another three people to move it up by another 20%, so that's on average 7% for each individual group member. And eventually, when there are five people or more, you see that there's no more additional influence. That's increasing the size of the majority, only increases conformity up to a point. But how come that the impact of the initial group members is higher than members that you add to the number of the majority? One thing is that the number in the group increases, individuals in the majority quickly come to be seen as a group rather than individuals. So here you see 1, 2, or 3 people standing and gawking into the sky, and 2 people or 3 people apparently have more impact than only one person. And 5 people are still more influential and make almost all passers-by stop, whereas here it's only 40 or 50%. But as soon as this number is exceeded, as soon as there are more than 5 people, they are seen as one group. And whether it's 5 or 6 or 10 people, it's still one group that has this influence over us. And another reason is predicted by the theory of optimal distinctiveness. I think I mentioned this a little bit in the session on self and identity. Social identity theory claims that we all have this need to identify and belong to social groups. But Marilyn Brewer, as a representative of the American mainstream research, hardly or seriously influenced by the individualistic approach, formulated optimal distinctiveness theory to balance out the individual's need to individually stand out, stick out with their strengths and accomplishments, achievements, particularly in individualistic societies, and this collectivistic tendency that we want to be group members. So we all have this ambivalent or ambiguous needs for belonging to a group, but at the same time not losing our individuality when we describe and define ourselves and when we are seen and described by others as part of a group rather than an individual. And therefore, Marilyn Brewer said, we tend to identify with medium-sized groups or small groups and not very large ones. And did I mention this already? Yeah. StudiVZ and Stefan Braun and his study on identification with smaller, medium-sized or large groups. And even on StudiVZ, we could find this effect that people tend to identify with smaller groups because in smaller groups, individuals are still visible. I can still feel as Rolf van Dyck in a group of 10 professors in a department. It's difficult to feel as an individual if I define myself as a member of Goethe University with 50,000 people. And when there are a lot of people in the majority, individuals may feel the need to maintain their individual identity by simply not conforming what the group wants them to do. So maybe these 20% who do not conform are different people across the conditions. And in these conditions, it's probably the 20% who do not want to give up their individuality. And as soon as there is a group that they see, they distance themselves from it, whereas when they see two or three people doing something, then they are influenced by them as individuals. Another factor that reduces social impact is consistency or unanimity of the group members. So even if the group gets larger, social impact is reduced if there's less unity or uniformity in this majority. And it may be even more important than the size of the majority. Ash effects happened not just because the Confederates gave a wrong answer, but because they all gave the same incorrect answer. And Ash also conducted a follow-up study in which he increased the number of Confederates to 16, as we have seen, but just one of these other Confederates gave the correct answer. And then he found that conformity was sharply reduced to only 5%. Compared to, what was the number in the original study? 76? I think it was 76. So in the original study, when there were five Confederates before the real participant, who all gave the same incorrect answer, 76% of the participants at least once also gave the same incorrect answer. When there were up to 16 group members as Confederates who gave the wrong answer before the real participant, and only one of them provided the correct answer, only 5% were influenced by the other 15 Confederates. So conformity is reduced even when the one dissenting Confederate gives a different answer, and that can be the one correct answer or another wrong answer. So when the correct answer is B and 11 people say A, but one Confederate says C, even then conformity was reduced. Why is this? Why is unanimity so important? And there are four factors. The first factor is when there's complete agreement among the majority members, the individual who is the target of influence stands alone. There are five or six or 10 people before me. They all give the wrong answer, and I know it's the wrong answer, but I'm alone, and now I'm the first one who have to break ranks. And this can be embarrassing. Maybe I'm not 100% sure whether my ostensibly correct perception is correct or not. Maybe I just don't want to say anything different from the others, but it's potentially embarrassing and therefore participants avoid it. When there's complete agreement, the participant may become less sure of his conflicting judgment and particularly his perceptions. The individual may be likely to conform because of informational conformity. He might think, maybe there's something wrong with my eyes today. Probably they are right, informational conformity. When one or more of the other group members gives a different answer from the rest of the group so that unanimity is broken, that person changes from being part of the majority to being part of a new group me, the real participant, and one other person. So now we are already a small group, and as soon as the individual has someone who agrees with him or her, they no longer need to conform. Having one or more supporters who challenge the status quo validates one's own opinion, so it reduces informational conformity, but it also makes disagreeing with the majority less fearful and therefore reduces normative conformity. Okay? Any questions? Okay, another determinant, and all these experiments have been heavily criticized at the time and also later on because it's so trivial. So you see a spot in the dark, move or not move, you have to estimate the number of lines, it's trivial. What does it have to do with the real world? What happens when you have to make decisions in groups that matter? Maybe you don't find any majority influence and normative influence. Maybe when it's about things that people care about, you only find informational influence and only the quality of the arguments counts. And Barron and colleagues wanted to test this, and in 1996 they conducted a modification of the line procedure, but this time they used more real-world material. They used a lineup scenario or study. So the participants saw one person, and then they saw four people in a lineup, and they should quickly decide who is the right person. So it was not lines, it was people. And unfortunately, Barron and colleagues confounded the effect, and they made two manipulations that increased or decreased importance of the task. In the high importance conditions, they said, we are asked by the local court to make some important recommendations for how they present people in a lineup study and what we will recommend in the future. What we will recommend will in the future change how the legal system will operate the task. So if I know it's an eyewitness task that the experimenters do in collaboration with the authorities, then I may be motivated to do my best and to give accurate perceptions as much as I can, compared to the other condition where the experimenter says, oh, it's just a pilot test that we want to study to see whether we can use that material in other experiments. So then you may think, okay, it's just a pilot study and I don't know whether the outcome of what will happen today will have any effect in the future or not. But unfortunately, Barron and colleagues also gave a financial rewards in the high importance condition, and they said, the group of people who makes correct responses will receive $20 reward for their correct answers. So we don't know whether the effects that I will show you in a moment are due to the financial rewards or whether they are due to having manipulated the task as an eyewitness or a pilot experiment, pilot study. Maybe some of you want to test this again in your bachelor thesis and disentangle the two effects. But what we can say is that this sounds much more important than this sounds, no matter whether it's because of the money or because of the described nature of the task. What they also differed was the time. So they were seeing the slides either very long for 5 to 10 seconds on each trial, or only very briefly for 0.5 seconds or 1 second at maximum. And apparently when the slide is gone after 1 second, you find it more difficult to decide who was the right person or who was the same person than when you can watch at it for a long time. And these were results. On easy tasks, participants conformed less when they thought that the decision was of high importance. So it was easy. I can see the pictures. For 5 to 10 seconds, And I'm pretty sure whether it's person A, B, C, or D. And I know it's important, so we will lose money if I give the wrong answer, or I will contribute to the research that is important to me, not as much as I could, when I tell a lie, when I do as the ones before me have done. So in this easy task, important condition, participants conformed less, participants conformed more when it's not important to them. When the task was difficult, you see that there was also an average effect of task difficulty. So when the task difficulty, there's an average main effect that people showed a little bit more conformity than when the task was easy. But this time they conform more when it's highly important than when it's not so important. And this is probably partly true due to informational conformity, because the standard picture and the reference picture was gone, taken away so quickly, I'm not so sure. And particularly when it's important, I do as the ones before me have said, probably because they have paid more attention or they know more about whatever it is. Okay? So, and this was research up until well into the 1950s and 60s. Solomon Esch, Muzaffar Sharif, and Latani and colleagues who did this majority influence, social impact, group norm research. And then a French researcher, Serge Moscovici, said, yeah, but if it's only my majority influence, how would we then find creative ideas? How come that there's innovation in the world when it's always only the majority that influences people's opinion? Then how can you explain the success of the civil rights movement in the US, of the student revolts in Paris and Frankfurt and Berlin, of the feminist movement, all these movements of the 1960s that started with minorities and still had an impact? And so he wanted to study, can minorities have an impact, and what are the conditions under which minorities have a larger impact, and are there different processes behind majority and minority influence? And the first experiment he conducted at the end of the 1960s was the classic experiment, similar setup as in the Esch study, but this time he did not use lines, but slides. And the slides were all blue. I hope so. Yes, they were all blue, but the Confederates in some trials said that they were green. And what he did was, now he had a minority of Confederates, two, and a majority of real participants, four. So this time it was a minority's job to try to influence the four real participants. So there was a slide, you were one of the participants, starting as number three, four, five, or six in the experiment, and before you there were two research Confederates that you didn't know, obviously, and both of them said the slide was green. You see there's a blue slide. Now, you don't know what is going on, but in, in the consistent minority condition, 10% of participants gave the wrong answer, so, and they went with the consistent minority. Oh, it's 8%, about 8%. 32% of participants said green at least once. 8% of the responses of the majority over all the trials were green. The inconsistent minority condition, where the Confederates called the slides green in only 25% of the trials and called them correctly blue in three quarters of the trials, did not have much of an effect over a control condition. So you can see in a control condition when there was no majority or minority influence, when the participants were alone and simply had to identify whether it was a blue or green slide, there were almost no mistakes. The inconsistency did not have a significant effect, but the consistent minority, in which all the slides were called green instead of blue, did have an influence. For Moscovici, that argued that minorities could have an influence over majorities, but only if they gave a unanimous response. And the question now is it two processes or one? And you saw that the numbers are lower than the numbers in Ash's studies. So in Ash's studies, I think it was 76% instead of 32%. And therefore, social impact theory would say that conformity depends on three variables: strengths, immediacy, and number. Strengths is things like status and expertise of either the minority or majority members who try to influence the real participants. And in these studies, there was no difference in status or expertise. It was not that some participants were introduced as experts on line judgments or experts on color identification tasks. They had the same status as research participants. Immediacy is how close the majority or minority members are to the real participant. Or say in Milgram's terms, whether the experimenter is in the same room or on the telephone. So immediacy has an effect on people's change in attitude or persuability. But in these cases, neither in Ash studies nor in Moscovici studies, there was any difference in immediacy. They were all sitting around the same table and not in a different room or connected via tape recorder or whatever. So the only variable that matters according to social impact theory is N, the number of people. And if everything else being equal, if immediacy and strength being equal, only the number of people influences the outcome, how many people give the wrong response. I mentioned this. Moscovici, however, argued that there were substantial differences between minority and majority influence. When a message comes from a majority group, it is easily accepted as being valid simply because so many people believe it. But we do not really look deep into the arguments. We do not study the material so hard. If 1,000 people tell us to eat this, then we eat it. If only 2 people say this, and they are new and they are minorities, say a vegan or someone who eats grasshoppers, then we study the material. We want to get receive more information. We want to be sure before we try the new food. So the majority influence does not really involve any thinking about the message itself. It's rather the source, the number of people that has the influence. Persuasion attempts that come from the minority obviously do not have the advantage of the number. So the minority can only produce influence by convincing the majority that the minority's opinions are true and valid. So Moscovici argued that arguments from the minority leads people to really focus on the message. And the cognitive activity involved in listening to and evaluating the message that is provided by the minority may, in some circumstances, when there's unanimity, etc., lead to private acceptance, where the majority, according to Moscovici, can only produce public compliance. So information coming from a majority group, according to the dual process theory, triggers compliance to social norms, but without real change in opinion. information coming from a minority group triggers this validation process, focusing on the message, processing the information, and this leads to informational conformity or private acceptance of the message. To be able to do that, minority members need to be unambiguous and unanimous in their responses, but they should also produce their arguments in a flexible way. I think that's on a later slide, and not to be seen as rigidly following their orders. And evidence for the dual process approach comes from the fact that when people give their statements openly, they are sometimes different than when people give their statements privately. If it's a uniform social impact theory, then it should not matter whether we are influenced by a minority of five or by a majority of five people, whether we make our statements private or public. But when Moscovici is true, then only in this situation, the minority influence, informational conformity should lead us to believe the message and also make the expected statements in private, whereas this effect should go down when the majority influences us and we don't evaluate the message itself, but in public we simply say what the majority wants us to say, whereas in private we stick to our previous or old attitude. And this has been studied by Anne Maas and Clark in the 80s. They have presented messages from an alleged majority or minority, and the majority and minority were either pro or anti-homosexuality. You see, when there was no influence, no control group, people in both groups estimate own attitude towards homosexuality was somewhere in the middle of a 7-point scale. When people gave their attitudes in public, so they had to announce their statement of this 7-point scale, whether they are in favor or not in favor of homosexuality in public, then they were influenced by the majority. When the majority was pro-gay and the minority anti, the public attitude was more pro-gay compared to the control condition. When the majority was anti and the minority pro, the public attitude went up a little bit and was more pro-anti. So the public attitude is influenced by what the majority says. When the majority is anti, then there's a little more anti than in the control condition. When the majority is pro, then there's a little bit more public attitudes towards pro. And the opposite is true when we give our private attitudes. Our private attitudes are influenced by the minority, and when the minority is anti, in private we are influenced and also make more anti ratings on the 7-point scale, and the opposite when the minority is pro. So you would not expect these effects if we only have social impact theory, if there's no differences in status and in immediacy of the people in the majority or in the minority, but only a difference in number, then we would expect that both lines would go up or down relatively in parallel. But you see that there's a big difference. And to test this, Moscovici conducted another experiment, which was very clever. That is the final slide. The real participant sat together with another participant, again, to identify blue or green slides. They were all blue, but the real participant and the confederate sometimes said that the slides were green. This participant was either described as a member of the majority, so the experimenter introduced this other participant and said that this other participant did already participate in other experiments, and in 90% of the conditions he was in line with what the majority of people would say in these tasks. In the other condition, he was described as a minority member. So these participants participated already, and only in 10% of the trials he gave an answer that would reflect a majority's view. So he's representing a minority of students. Now, the interesting thing was that Moscovici and colleagues in these experiments did not ask the real participant for which color do you see, but they asked them to write down the after image after the slide was taken away. And most people do not know immediately what the after image of blue and green would be. The after image of blue is yellow. So when you look at a blue slide for a moment and then that slide is gone, then you see a yellow after image. The after image of green is purple. So the higher the amount on this scale, the more people would be influenced by the majority or minority influence in these three phases, because the influence would be that they believe that the slide was actually green, so that they have the perception to see a purple after image. Phase one, before any influence, you see 1 is yellow, 9 is purple. On average, they all say 5, irrespectively of being in the majority or minority condition. So in this condition, the Confederate was not present, so why should there be a difference? And it tended towards yellow, which is correct because the slides were blue. You see, when the Confederate was present, when they gave their response. In the majority condition, they tended towards yellow. In the minority influence condition, they tended towards purple. And when the Confederate was absent again and the real participant was alone, minority influence went down. Majority influence went down again. Minority influence even went up. So when we are influenced by the majority, we are not influenced. When we are influenced by the minority, influence is immediate and still continues even when the person who is trying to influence us is no longer in the room. It's a little bit tricky, the experiment. It's very clever. The big problem is, and there's a whole page in the textbook about this, it could never be replicated. So we don't know whether there was any mistake in Moscovici's data or analysis, or whether Moscovici just wanted it to be true in terms of a self-fulfilling prophecy or experimental Rosenthal effect. Or whether he was just lucky and found the effects in one experiment that many colleagues in follow-up studies could not find. Clearly, it would speak to two different processes of influence: informational influence over the minority group, conformity in the effect of the majority, which is in line with what Annemars and others have found. But from this specific experiment, we should be careful or cautious not to do, from this experiment, not to draw too firm conclusions, because, and particularly now in the discussion of the replication crisis in social psychology and other areas of psychology and social sciences, I would not normally believe a single experiment when it cannot be replicated, despite several attempts to do so. And that means I'm at the end. So Eichmann in Jerusalem is really an interesting book. Have a look into this. And next week we start with the two multiple choice questions. Thank you very much. Have a good week.